cause, Robert L. Harris, Jr., Appellant Counsel, Claire B. Michelson, Appellate Counsel.
You may proceed.
Chief Justice Lemons, members of the Supreme Court of Virginia, my name is Robert L. Harris, Jr. I represent the appellant, James David Everett II. This is a domestic relations case limited to a very discreet issue, and that is whether, two issues, whether the trial court may modify retroactively a pendente Leidy spousal support award. It has the power to do so, that is. And if so, whether in this case the trial court abused its discretion when it failed to modify retroactively the spousal support award. By way of background, David Everett is a chef and part owner of three restaurants in Williamsburg, Virginia. They are called The Trellis, Blue Talon Bistro, and Dog Street Gastro Pub. He is a member of LLCs. He is paid in two formats. One, a guaranteed payment of $10,000 per month from one of the three restaurants, and the second form of payment is in form of distributions, which are made in the discretion of the LLC to its members based upon ownership interest. That's a very big issue in this case because as members of LLCs, they are taxed based upon the income allocated to them, not on the actual distributions received.
May I ask you this?
Yes, sir.
If we were to reverse and say, no, of course, Judge, you're dealing with an interlocutory order, and of course you can reconsider it any time before final judgment, there really wasn't any consideration of the merits. Why would we decide the merits on appeal? Why wouldn't you just remand it and say, you do have the authority, you can't really chicken out, you do have to exercise your authority, and you may, in your discretion, do a lot of different things. Wouldn't that be the right answer as opposed to us deciding it on the appeal?
I'm not asking this court to rule as a matter of fact, I understand, Justice Kelsey, that the arrearage of $66,000 and change was erroneous. I'm asking this court to remand to the trial court the ruling and to vacate the judgment for the arrearage and to ask the trial court to consider whether any arrearage should exist.
Well, great. So suppose we did exactly that and I was the trial judge and it came back to me and I went, well, I thought I was following the law, but I was wrong. I have the authority, I'm not going to chicken out. Well, you're asking me to reconsider something that happened months before. My colleague heard this, you know, the evidence you're talking about now should have been presented earlier. In my discretion, I'm just not going to reconsider it, even though I obviously have the power to. Couldn't the judge do that?
I don't think this case Judge Maxfield could do so because he's already stated repeatedly at multiple hearings, both in March of 2017, in June of 2017, and finally after the third day of trial, the four-day trial, that there was an injustice that occurred here, that in fact he found that he's not sure legally that any arrearage should exist. He made that finding in March of 2017.
So he tied his hands in terms of his own discretion if we were to remand it.
I'm not saying, Your Honor, he has tied his hands. I'm saying he has made a finding that there was an injustice. The question is, to what extent is he going to incur that injustice monetarily? He has made a finding clearly that an injustice occurred, that it was in fact a waste of the court's time to have attempted to hold this gentleman in contempt of court.
And he could have denied contempt of court without touching, as he did, the underlying order.
Yes.
But under your argument, if you win this case, would the trial judge be able to say this on remand, based upon your argument? It is an injustice. But the problem is, if the prior judge had known all this at the right time, they would have got it right. But they didn't. And for the sake of argument, maybe you could be blamed for that, or your side of the case could be blamed for that. Could a trial judge say, look, we can't have dozens of reconsideration orders constantly coming through the docket, and you should have brought all this out early? Yeah, it's an injustice, but it's not the court's fault. Is that one of the things on the table? That's all I'm asking.
If I understand Your Honor's question, and I'm not trying to evade it, I think this, in this case, Judge Maxfield found that the prior judge, Judge Ford, had not understood the facts. It was not a matter of counsel's not presenting evidence. It was a matter of the prior trial judges sitting and not understanding that, in fact, gross income under the Ninth Circuit guidelines is not equal to the sum of distributions and guaranteed payments.
So this wasn't an after-discovered evidence argument or anything?
No, sir. This, in fact, Your Honor, Judge Ford remarked in the hearing in October of 2016 that he thinks the money ought to be there because there appears to be gross income, and the money is, quote, adjustable in terms of income, and I need an expert. He actually said on the record, I need an expert. We filed a motion to reconsider, and incident to the motion for show cause was heard at the same time, and we brought that expert. Ms. Taws has acknowledged in her brief that we presented substantially the same evidence, quote unquote, and this is stated in the brief, in the hearing in March, except frankly, we just dressed it up with an expert to explain that gross income is not representative of actual income in this case, and that it could be an injustice to rely on gross income under the Ninth Circuit guidelines to inflate one's ability to pay support. And in fact, we pointed out, again, we pointed out that in one of the cases, the cases of the trellis by specific illustration, that Mr. Everett received $24,000, income was allocated to him for $24,000 in 2016, and yet he did not receive any money in 2016.
Right, the bottom line is, perhaps in a different case, the court could stand on its prior ruling and say, I'm not going to reconsider because of whatever, but in this case, if the evidence is clear that it was phantom money that he was asked to pay support from, and that none of that's changed or was flawed or whatever, then how could the court not reconsider? Because we don't expect people to pay support at all that they don't have.
Justice McCall, I wholly agree with you, but in this case, Justice Kelly was looking, he's not boxed himself in. Judge Maxfield stated that an injustice has occurred here, but I'm not sure I can do anything about it. He asked us to brief
counsel,
it.
Yes, ma'am. I'll interrupt you. Remind me again, how many months elapsed between the first order that you allege was erroneous and the second time you went back on your motion to reconsider?
The order was entered in December of 2016, and I don't know the exact date, I think it was December 13, and on or about March 6, as I recall, 2017. We had a three-hour, it was because of a lengthy hearing, it was delayed in part because we had to schedule a three-hour hearing on cross motions.
When did you
file? It was approximately 4 months.
When did you file your motion to reconsider?
I don't recall. I think we filed the motion to reconsider once we got a hearing date. It was probably early March or late February. I don't recall. It's in the record. We filed the motion to reconsider. By that time, several more months of arrearage had accrued. And as a result of this ruling...
In March,
yes,
the court says grave injustice.
Hmm.
What is the best language from the court's recitation when it's entering its final, when it's making its final decision, that it had not perhaps rethought its position and decided, I have the ability to adjust it, but I'm just not going to do it? What's the best language that tells me that when it finally made its ruling that it maintained the notion of grave injustice, somebody should do something?
The final decree, the final order does not recite that language.
What about this language?
Yes, ma'am. From the bench on the third day of trial, Justice Powell, he said, that is ground I am just not going to cover.
And so how do I know that he didn't decide in that interim period, yeah, I thought it was an injustice, I've sort of looked at it, and I'm just not going to do anything about it?
Well, we know this. We know that he said in March of 2017 that if we brief this issue, and we did brief this issue, we went back in June of 2017 when he said he was chickening out of ruling, and I'm quoting him. He said that if I find that it was improper, then I may make an adjustment to the equitable distribution award. And in fact, he didn't make any adjustment to the equitable distribution award. We know that because he made the ruling about not changing the arrearage after the third day of trial before he had ruled on equidistribution at the close of the fourth day of trial. So there was no adjustment to the equidistribution award. In fact, it was consistent with what the parties stipulated, and that is to say that the marital estate be divided equally.
I understand that. I want you to point me to anything in his discussion when he's telling you what he's going to do, that he's not going to make an adjustment, that would reiterate the march, it was an injustice, and I'm just not going to address it, as opposed to maybe he rethought it and just decided not to, to make an adjustment.
Well, I quote him in the opening brief, Your Honor, in which he states in day four, that is the day he ruled on equal distribution and on spousal support, in which he awarded $4,800 a month, he said that the prior award, I will note, is far less than the Pendini-Leidy award, and that the Pendini-Leidy award left him barely anything to live on. That is in the record from the bench, but it is not recited as a finding of fact in the final decree. So what we're saying is the combined cash award and in-kind payments for Ms. Taw's benefit were about $14,000 per month under the Pendini-Leidy order. He made the remark when he awarded full support of $4,800 a month that the prior award left him nothing to live on, in effect. But in terms of getting back to Justice Kelsey's comment, I see I have 4 minutes. Again, he did not box himself in. He found an injustice.
I think may have misinterpreted, or maybe I misspoke earlier.
Okay.
It seems to me that your best argument is that this trial court declined the exercise of reconsideration authority on the mistaken assumption that it didn't exist.
That is correct. Under the Lawler case that's cited in the brief, when a court, and this court has laid out three criteria.
The point there is that's not discretion. That's just a mistake.
Well, as I stated in the brief, inaction is not discretion.
Right. Now, if he'd have gone further and said, you know what, I don't know if I have authority or not, but I'm going to address the merits and plow through the evidence and plow through the gross versus net income numbers and say it's not worth reconsidering, that'd be a completely different case.
Well, he intimated that he was doing that in March of 2017 on the show cause, but he simply said, I don't know that I have the ability. I want you all to brief this issue about whether I have the ability, that is the power, to retroactively modify support. To the third day of trial, he always stated that he may make an adjustment to the ED award. However, he stated before the fourth day of trial, before the award of support, I'm not going to change it.
So he had three options. He could, one, I'm not going to reconsider, I have the power, I have the discretion, but for whatever reason you waited too late or something like that. Or two, I'm going to leave it as is, I'm not going to actually change the Pendini-Leidy order, but I'm going to do some adjustments to ED to make it all work out fair in the end, because we're talking about equity anyway. Or three, it is what it is, it's done, I'm not going to worry about it. And that sounds like what you're saying he did.
He did the third, yes, sir. I'd like to reserve my last 2 minutes to 10 seconds for rebuttal.
2 minutes, 17 seconds.
17 seconds. Thank you, Justice.
May it please the Court. My name is Claire Butler Michelson, and I am here on behalf of Catherine Jean Taws. I have written the brief for Mrs. Taws at the Court of Appeals level, and at this level, I did not represent her at the trial court level. The big question that the court is facing that is of precedential value is clearly whether or not the court has the authority to retroactively modify Pendente-Leite spousal support.
How could it not? It's an interlocutory order.
I'm sorry?
It's an interlocutory order. There's no law of the case with interlocutory order. There's no stare decisis. There's no res judicata. There's nothing. A judge can simply change his or her mind for any reason with an interlocutory order.
They can do it prospectively when it comes to support. Child support is specifically, you may not determine that any child support order is retroactively modifiable prior to the date of filing a petition. It's very clear.
The anti-retroactivity statutes have always been interpreted to apply to final orders, but your interpretation applies to interlocutory orders. And what's the best argument that that's the way this works? Because as you know from your practice, you're constantly, Pendente-Leite is a fluid thing that goes throughout the whole case until the very end. You've got to have tons of flexibility because people make up things and you find out later it's wrong and there's evidence that that comes to light later, why would we strip the court of that power?
Well, as I've mentioned before, with child support, there is no discretion. Once an arrearage is established, you cannot retroactively modify it. When it comes to spousal support, the same rules of construction should apply. The whole purpose of pendente lite spousal support is to allow a litigant to carry on a case. They have to be able to have the money to carry on a case, especially in a situation where they are not the breadwinner.
The breadwinner has a policy that says you should be able to carry on the case on an obvious error that creates injustice. Carry on. There's an injustice, but carry on. We want to pay you more than you're entitled to so you can carry on the case. Where's the justice in that?
Well, Your Honor, what happens is, in this case, there was a trial. There was a hearing by one judge, and then another judge heard the same evidence and saw it differently. If there's a problem during the interlocutory period, you can always have the motion to reconsider, like that happened in this case. And in March of that year, in March of 2017, the judge did modify it. There was the arrearage ceased in March of 2017 when the petition was filed by Mr. Everett. So the problem, though, is if the court takes the position that any arrearage that's been established can be eradicated at the final decree, then they have no value because nobody's going to pay it. Nobody's going to pay.
Yeah, but there's the contempt sort of Damocles hanging over your head. I mean, so if a client comes in, I say, oh, just blow it off. You know, we'll file a motion to reconsider. You don't know how that's going to go, number one. And number two, you end up in the clink or a stern talking to by the judge. It's an uncomfortable place to be. I mean, is that really a realistic problem?
Yes, well, I think it is because, first of all, it depends on the length of time between when the order's entered and when the trial happens. But, yes, it can. There's a lot of time sometimes in these pendente lite orders. A lot of time goes by. A lot of money is needed to carry on a case, and they can go on for a long period of time.
Right.
And the litigant needs to depend on that money being paid to him or her. And then if the court determines, well, I'm not going to enforce my orders until the end, and they just don't have any value. Yes, there is the show cause
order. Can I stop you saying that's a different issue? Because if the question is whether or not the court's going to enforce this order, that's not the same as retroactively changing it.
Well, the problem, though, Your Honor, is permanent support is not modifiable unless there's a petition filed, and it's only modifiable back to that amount, spousal support.
Yeah,
so there should be no differentiation, though, between temporary. The whole purpose of support is for the person receiving it to rely on it, to be able to depend on it, and to know that that's going to get them through whatever they need.
But the other side of that question, though, is, I mean, say it's a math error. I mean, just a flat-out computational error. I mean, are you saying tough? You know, they added a zero instead of 1,000 is 10,000 for some, you know, car mechanic or something. And your point, can't be retroactively modified? Really?
If an arrearage is established and put into an order, then that's what the arrearage is. I think if there's a clerical error, I think people would take care of that. I mean, the judge, you know, I've never heard of a judge entering an order where there's an extra couple zeros added onto an arrearage.
Well,
But that same argument would hold true for a final support order. What if the final support order said that and had the extra zeros in it? The statute's very clear.
Yeah, but quite honestly, if it's a final support order and those extra zeros are there, and you've had the opportunity to appeal it, and the Court of Appeals has looked at it, and we've looked at it, and that's still $10,000. You owe that money.
Well, correct. But
yeah.
But the purpose, though, I think what we have to do is we have to look at the statutory construction, and I pointed this out in my brief. We have to look at all the other statutes that the court has, and I mean that the legislature has. And there are all of the other statutes, including ones where you have the child support, interlocutory child support, as I mentioned before. They all say any support obligation is a judgment as a matter of law when it becomes due. They don't differentiate in any of the statutes between.
But if they didn't put that in this statute, doesn't that indicate that it ought not be true in this particular instance?
Your Honor,
doesn't that kind of prove the point?
Your Honor,
it's different.
The authority that the court has to do anything with regard to spousal support is all statutory. So,
but 103 doesn't include that judgment language that you are relying on for final decrees.
Correct, but the other parts of the statute, including 20-112, that's the that's the part of the statute that allow of the legislature that allows a court to modify a decree. If we didn't have 20-112 and we didn't have those language, the language in 20-107.1 that specifically talks about retroactive to the date of filing for a modification, the court would never be able to modify spousal support. All of it's statutory. So we can't say that it is implied that they can modify it under 20-103 only because it doesn't say they can.
Why is that difficult to imply when, as far as I know, correct me if this is an overstatement, every interlocutory order entered by a trial court prior to final judgment, absent a statute saying otherwise, is subject to the court's reversal, reconsideration, or anything else. Is that an overstatement?
Your Honor, I think there is an exception statutorily to support.
Well, let me read, because
what's the statute then?
Well, the child support statute specifically says it cannot be modified.
Okay, great.
That's it's not child support. What else?
But it is support. It's in the nature of support. But the other parts of the statute, 20-107.1, they don't differentiate. They say any support order. If you look at 20-109, where it references 20-109 references the changing of an order, and that statute specifically says. And I'll point it out to the court here. Locating the statute, Your Honor. But that statute says that any orders of support at 20-109, Section A, any orders of support may not be modified prior to the date of filing a petition. I'll read it specifically. The provisions of this subsection shall apply to all orders and decrees for spousal support. Doesn't differentiate between temporary and permanent. All orders or decrees for spousal support, regardless of the date of the suit for initial setting of support, the date of entry of any such order or decree, or the date of any petition for modification of support. This is 20-109, changing maintenance and support for a spouse.
But a petition is an affirmative pleading. It's not a motion for a patente lite. A petition is a suit. So it's presupposing that there's some final order you're dealing with, and you're petitioning to get it changed.
Well, that language says, regardless of those dates, it says, shall apply to all orders and decrees for spousal support. And 20-112, and I do think that statutory construction requires us to look at the totality of all of the statutes and what they mean.
So is the Court of Appeals wrong in 1, 2, 3 opinions, in which, including one of mine, it has said, the matter of patente lite support remains within the control of the court, and the court can change its mind while the matter is still pending before it. Is that wrong?
When it comes to support, I think there's a statutory acceptance.
Is it right or wrong?
It can do that in some instances and not all. Some instances it has to do it prospectively, and in this case that's what it did. A court can always look back and say, okay, I'm going to change the support order based on whatever circumstances mean that it was, in this case the judge felt like the guy, he couldn't afford it and he wasn't able to keep up with it, so he changed it.
So could you do it retroactively indirectly, which is what this trial judge was actually thinking? It was clever, I think, but he didn't do it.
Well, yes, the way he said he was going to do it was not correct.
Yeah, well, could he do it? I mean, in other words, could he, if, under your argument, your understanding of the law, could a trial judge say, okay, the Supreme Court's told me I can't correct this egregious mistake. There's $10,000 overpayment. It's totally unjust. She's not entitled to it at all. I'll take it out of the ED award somewhere or somewhere else when I finally get to trial.
That would be completely improper because the equal distribution award is supposed to be decided prior to the spousal support award.
Okay, so therefore, if there's an injustice, like he's claiming there is an injustice and someone made a mistake between gross and net income, which is a pretty obvious mistake, it's unappealable. You can't do a thing about it. And it's never subject to reconsideration. If it happens on Tuesday's docket, you get back on Wednesday's docket, and you, judge, we made a huge mistake here. I'm sorry, I misspoke or something. Net is different from gross income. Can't do anything about it. And if the case goes on the docket until final ED award 2 years later, there's $50,000 in accrual that everyone in the courtroom knows is just unjust. That's what you're saying?
Well, there is the remedy of asking, as Mr. Harris did do, for a motion for reconsideration and showing the court, look what's happening. he's not able to pay this, so please reconsider this award. He's falling further down into arrearages. That was his remedy, and you always have that remedy.
He came back in March and tried to do that.
Correct, and he succeeded.
But what about the $66,000 that he already owes? You're saying that there's no way in the world he can appeal that.
Well, yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. If it is accrued and it creates a judgment as a matter of law, as an interlocutory order, he can't.
It seems like the big problem with that is, in this particular instance, the arrear was created at the moment the court entered the order. Because they were saying these payments should have been made months ago and they weren't. And so today I'm entering an order saying that they were due. The dates have already passed when the money is owed, when the judge decides that it is owed.
Well, I will point out, Your Honors, if you look to other states, this issue's come up in plenty of other states, and some of them have addressed them in their statutes, some have just addressed them in their decisions. And one of them, and they all have agreed, this, I'm talking California, Connecticut, New York, Utah, they all agree that pendente lite orders should not be retroactively modifiable prior to a petition for modifying them, for all the same reasons that a regular final spousal support order is not done. And one of the things they point to is full faith and credit by other states.
We're talking statutes. You came to the podium and said this is entirely controlled by statutes.
Correct.
It's not controlled by statutes in Utah. It's Virginia. So what another state does makes no difference in this argument whatsoever. But let me ask you this question, which really, I think, is more troublesome. I hear your argument, and I hear his argument. It's like two ships passing in the night.
Mm-hmm.
What is before us? Do we have a case, as Mr. Harris suggests, that an error of law has occurred because the trial judge didn't think he had the authority to retroactively modify? That's one case.
Mm-hmm.
Or do we have what I think I'm hearing you saying, this is not a matter of an error of law. At best, it's a matter of discretion, and that's the case before us today. Which one of those cases is before us today? Error of law, matter of discretion.
I was actually concerned about why we were here today, too, because I don't think we have the correct fact pattern. I think that if the judge had decided that he was going to retroactively modify the support, then that would be properly before the court. But he had the discretion not to. He exercised his discretion, and whether or not he thought it was an injustice, he never said he couldn't do it. He questioned whether he could do it, and he decided he was going to he was chickening out. So he exercised his discretion and chose not to do it.
Well, you may be right. But what's interesting is, Mr. Harris, you need to address this when you get back up here, is that he mused quite long about the idea that he has no legal authority to do it. And then the case progressed and was brought back before him, and he said, whether or not I have the authority to vacate the pendente lite order is just ground I don't want to cover. So if it was a matter of a legal error, an error of law, did it morph over the course of the litigation into a question of discretion?
And I agree, Your Honor, it was discretion that he exercised.
How can it not be an abuse of discretion to force somebody to pay money that's completely phantom money?
Well, Your Honor, I think that there was evidence presented, appropriate evidence presented at the first hearing where the support and arrearage was established in October of 2016 that the money was there. I mean, the one judge saw the evidence one way, and one saw it another. I mean, it was the jurists differed on how they saw the evidence.
I'm not sure that's the case, but anyway.
I see my time is up.
Yes, it has. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Mr. Harris, what case do we have before us today? Is it a question of an error of law, or is it a matter of abuse of discretion?
They're twofold, Your Honor. I'm not evading the question. First, the threshold issue is, did Judge Maxfield error as a matter of law when he decided that he didn't know whether he had the power to exercise discretion? That is to say, I'm not sure I have the power to exercise the discretion to modify retroactively.
But did he actually morph the case into a discretionary call by saying, well, I've got this further request to reconsider, and I just want you to know whether or not I have the authority to vacate is just ground I don't want to cover?
That's just
so we no longer, perhaps, have the error of law question. What we have is the trial judge says, I'm not going to answer that question.
Clearly, Your Honor, he erred because he did not understand the limits of his power to modify retroactively under the law or become.
Well, I'm not sure that you understand my question.
Okay, I'm trying.
My question is, did he cover his tracks by saying, I don't know if I have the authority, but it doesn't matter? Because under no set of circumstances am I going to change this order. It's ground I just don't want to cover. Isn't that a discretionary call?
It was a discretionary call, and as I pointed out before, in light of Justice Kelsey's question, inaction is not an exercise of discretion.
We have cases about exercise of discretion. That's why I'm trying to put this case into a posture where we can answer what is exactly in front of us. The Waller case and other cases talk about abuse of discretion. If the discretionary decision is premised upon an error of law, that is a basis for reversal.
That is correct.
And nobody said that here today. So
well, no.
What I want to understand is, I think I understand clearly your position. I don't understand yours. What is it?
My position is that he had the power to retroactively modify support. He did not acknowledge that he had that power. He repeatedly stated, I don't know that I do have the power, so I'm not going to do anything. That's my position.
Right.
And having done nothing, he failed to exercise any discretion. I see my time is up.
All right.
Thank you.
Call the next case.